Welcome into another edition of the Dana and Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I am Rick, he is Dan, and Dan, once again, for this 42nd edition, we are joined by the legend, Brian Snow.
I'm here. I'm really cold in Indianapolis, but I know everyone missed me, and the podcast is going to be far better with my presence.
The Circle City, I believe they call that.
They do.
We have the whole tri-state represented here. I'm in Cincinnati, Snow's in Indianapolis, Rick's in Latonia, and
by the way, the earliest Latonia reference in podcasting,
can we take a 30-second break here? This will stay in, I hope. And Rick, why exactly were they digging a giant hole in your front yard?
My pipes burst out front. I had no water, Dan.
Okay, fair enough. Rick,
there's no good story to that other than I got woken up by giant machines in my front yard the other morning.
Well, it was 2 in the afternoon, let's be honest. But
it was 8 in the morning when that happened.
So, guys, episode number 42, this is an obvious choice. The great Tyrone Hill, one of the greatest players in Xavier history. Jersey hangs in the rafters at Cintas Center. And it's also a great segue, guys, because, of course, Tyrone Hill was part of that legendary Xavier team that made the Sweet 16 for the first time by beating Georgetown with Dikembe Mutombo and Alonzo Mourning. Great upsets, one of the great NCAA performances by a Xavier team in history. And that brings us to the present team. We're recording this on Wednesday night, the 22nd of January. Since we last spoke, the Musketeers beat Georgetown 80-67 at Cintas Center last Wednesday, overcoming a 17-point second-half deficit, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about that. On Monday, they traveled to Chicago to take on the DePaul Blue Demons, a rare afternoon start, Martin Luther King Day, and the Muskies had a big halftime lead, struggled a little bit in the second half, but held off DePaul 84-74. Xavier stands at 15-4 for the season, 5-1 in the Big East. That is a tie for second place with, I believe, Villanova, Creighton a half game ahead at 6-1, having just run off maybe one of the most impressive boat racings of all time the other day, hammering Nova on their home court. Gentlemen, let's start with the Georgetown game. Rick, just give me your overall thoughts of how this game went.
That game was awesome to watch. It was a lot of fun. It was a great second half to watch. Highly entertaining. But I think you just go back to how absurd it is. I just can't remember ever recalling seeing a team trail by 17 in the second half, make a ridiculous comeback like that, and then dribble out the clock and win by double digits. I can't recall watching that scenario take place.
Rick, I know I texted you after the game and I said that was absurd. I think that was the exact word I used. I've never seen that happen in a basketball game. Like, you don't dribble out the clock when you're down 17 in the second half.
Yeah, you have to be struggling in those final minutes. Like, guys should be exhausted and dead tired after making that type of swing. And Xavier was just, like, so calm those last minute 30 as they dribbled out the clock. It was ridiculous.
And if this was an NBA game and it was 48 minutes long, it would have been a 25-point beating. Like, that was not stopping.
Yeah. Well, guys, this was one of those things. I listened to Coach Mack's show on the way home. I kind of was shell-shocked, as probably everybody else that was in the arena was. And this strikes me as one of those things where coaches and fans, insiders and outsiders, sort of see things a different way. Because, of course, fans look at a comeback like this, or like the Purdue game a couple years ago, or if you want to look at a different sport like the Colts coming back on the Chiefs in the wild card round this year. And fans, this is like these are the most memorable games. You talk about how great the team's effort was and how awesome it was that they were able to overcome this deficit. Then you hear the coaches talk about it, and all the coaches are thinking about is, well, why the hell did we dig ourselves that big of a hole in the first place? It's like, now, Brian, you've said on many occasions that college basketball coaches are the most miserable people on earth, and that may well be true. But let's sort of, when I listened to Chris Mack after the game, he seemed to be harping on, you know, Joe or Byron would be like, well, what a great comeback. And he'd be like, yeah, but Joe, you know, the first half, we did this. So let me ask you guys, what were the deficiencies in Xavier's play in the first 25 minutes that allowed Georgetown to build that 17-point lead?
I would start by saying their energy wasn't what it's been. I mean, we can go into the nuts and bolts, but there was a deficiency is when it comes to the overall approach and energy that they've had that's made them so good over this winning streak that they've been on. Now the technical thing that I saw was the dribble handoffs killed them. Their shooters, especially DSR, was able to get behind screens on the dribble handoff, and Xavier got caught in between, and it looked like guys were walking on ice, and I think basically they were overthinking the pseudo Princeton offense that Georgetown runs. They got caught on a backdoor cutter too early, and I think that kind of got them thinking a little bit and playing a little conservative, and then they weren't in that chasing mentality when it came to the dribble handoffs, which let Georgetown step back for those easy threes, and they were just on fire in the first half.
Yeah, I mean, Xavier defends ball screens very simply. They do it the same way every time, no matter what, in that, you know, you don't hedge on the ball screen. You kind of, or excuse me, not a ball screen, a handoff. The guard comes over. The big just kind of stands his ground. And theoretically, the guard shouldn't be able to shoot over it. They didn't execute it really well. And also, Georgetown was doing it deep enough where, like, I don't think the Xavier guards and bigs really had a lot of urgency. And then they kept making shots, and it seemed like Xavier was kind of like, well, maybe they'll start missing soon. And they didn't. And then I think finally they got energy and, you know, kind of made it tougher to get to the handoff where they're going backwards a little bit, and they weren't able to come off of it in rhythm in the second half like they were in the first half.
Guys, I thought – I thought one of the critical moments of the game was just out of halftime. Now, Xavier trailed by 13 points going into the half, and X came out, and it was obvious that Chris Mack had peeled the paint off the walls of the locker room at halftime. They came out, they clamped the press on, they scored 7 quick points. And even though Georgetown turned around and was able to extend their lead by hitting, I think, 3 straight threes after that, I thought that 7-0 run really changed up the pace of the game and at least threw the momentum into doubt a little bit at that point. And even though it didn't make perhaps a difference in the finals or the game, I thought that short passage of play in the first couple minutes of the second half, particularly D. Davis getting involved offensively after being in foul trouble in the first half, was important. Do you guys agree with that, or what adjustments did you see that X made at halftime that maybe paid dividends down the stretch?
For me, I just think it showed that they gave a crap. It didn't necessarily, and I know they did give a crap in the first half, but it certainly it just they had a different bounce about them. And then Georgetown hit him with the 11-0. So really the scoring, I don't think mattered. It was just the energy level and the, hey, we're not going down without a fight, you know, kind of showed itself. So in that perspective, I think it mattered, but I don't think necessarily the scoring spurt itself mattered too much.
Yeah, I think the most interesting part about this Xavier team to me is that when they're in situations like that, that 17-point deficit, they don't have to do what DePaul did. Which is frantically try to go kamikaze and trap the ball and go nuts and try to get turnovers and everything. They play their style and stick to it. Maybe they increase the energy and the intensity on defense and on the glass, but they just stick to what they're doing, and it works eventually. And I thought that was what we saw in the second half. Is I had predicted this game to be, I think it was 11 or 12 is what I had predicted, and obviously, it didn't look good at first, but I thought what we saw in the second half was these two teams playing a lot closer to what they really are. Georgetown came back down to earth, and Xavier started playing with more energy and played to their potential. And I think that's the accurate spread for this team is about 80-67. That seems right from what we've seen from these two teams. And yeah, I mean, I agree with Snow. I think they came out with a different energy, and that was the biggest difference there in the second half.
Yeah, then they hit him with the press, and they got, I think, 3 turnovers in a row that led to maybe 7, 8, 9 points. And from then on, it was just an absolute curb stomping.
Yeah, and I was going to make that point, is that after they got down 17, X had about a 2-minute run from about the 15-minute mark to, I want to say, about the 12:40 mark, where they outscored Georgetown something like 11-3, and they cut the lead back into single digits. And then they went back and forth for a couple minutes, and then they had another quick spurt like that, like 11-3 or 11-4, that cut the lead down to the one possession game, and then eventually Miles hit the three and the floodgates opened. But I think that's the Rick, I think that is one of the biggest differences between this year's team and last year's team. Because last year we talked about the fact that, oh, yeah, X went on a 8-minute defensive tear where the other team only scored 3 points and X scored four. Right. You know, right. There was no ability to
pull away.
To put the pedal down, to put the car in that next gear and pull away from a team. And we saw it so many times last year where X would have, you know, a 9, 10, 11 point lead and they just couldn't do anything with it because they couldn't score the basketball with any consistency. And this year's team, I mean, obviously offensively, they've made a massive step forward.
I was going to say, I think a big part of that is just the fact that when they or not even just a big part of it, but just, it's fun to watch when they do get those stops, they score effortlessly at times. I mean, when they start getting on a roll like that and they get stops, you can see the confidence building this team. And when they get some rhythm to them going on the offensive end, they're really difficult to stop. And I think a huge part of that is the play of D. Davis, the way he's been going, and especially in this game. They were plus 29 with him on the court. Insane. And he sat out most of the first half because of foul trouble, but his defense and offense in the second half was huge.
Yeah, Rick, I just want to point out one thing. I think a big reason, getting back to Dan's point, why this Xavier team doesn't have those just incredible scoring droughts is, I remember, I go back to a podcast I think we did at the end of last season, and we kind of asked one player who played better than his numbers might show and one who played worse than his numbers might show. And for me, it was Travis Taylor, because, you know, in the scouting business, we would say he's someone who couldn't score in a certain type of house. And that was exactly they had no one. You couldn't throw it to him on the block and get a bucket. They can this year with Stainbrook, either through him scoring or him setting up a bucket with his passing.
What and kind I think of house was that? Like a duplex or like a four family or what? I mean,
a well-populated house.
Fair enough.
And so I think when you have that now, it makes it easier and you're not as relying on jump shots, or in Xavier's case, you know, Samaje putting his head down and driving to the rim. So I think that's where the lack of the stopping the scoring problem comes from. When getting to Rick's point, I don't think people have any clue how good D. Davis is playing right now. I mean, he's their best player right now, even with the ridiculous numbers Samaje is putting up.
Yeah, and it's just because how well he's making the entire team play. When he's on the court, that offense is completely different because he's understanding how to get everyone involved, the pace to play at, when to push it, when to not. And he really seems like he's in sync with Chris Mack. And it's funny because coming out of the Bahamas, it just didn't seem like that was the case at all. And he looked so poor there with his play that he has completely turned it around. He's been unbelievable the last few weeks. And I do have to say, the floater that he dished up, I gave it a 7 on the Drew Lavender floater scale. Pretty nice. About 6 feet, I'd say.
I thought Samaje's bank shot was pretty impressive too during the run. And that was the best thing about that. Xavier closed the game in the last 15 minutes on a 44-14 run. And as you watch it, I'm walking out of the building and my sister was like, was there any, like, we were so sort of overwhelmed with the way the game had gone. She was like, was there any one player that sort of was driving the bus during that run? And I was like, no, everybody kind of chipped in.
Well, Samaje went off the court. I mean, he helped get him back to it, but he was off the court for the whole time they took over and ran away with it.
Right, but you run down the roster. James Farr had a 3. Isaiah Fillmore had huge free throws down the stretch. D. Davis was running the show the whole time. Stainbrook had that giant basket after Miles hit the 3-pointer to put him ahead. The next time down, they worked the ball into Stainbrook, and he had a great finish. Justin Martin had some buckets in there. I mean, everybody was contributing. And that was it was amazing to watch because it was just like that was the best sequence of Xavier basketball that I can recall for seasons. And I mean, there have been teams that have been better than this one, but to watch 15 minutes of pure team basketball like that was amazing. I mean, you contrast it to the last huge comeback that Xavier had, which was the Purdue game 2 years ago at CentOS. That was about Tu Holloway basically putting the team on his back and just walking down the court and just hitting heat check after heat check after heat check. This game was not like that at all. This was just a full on demolition of the entire Georgetown team by Xavier. And it didn't matter who they brought off the bench. They were producing.
Yeah. I mean, this game, it reminded me of two games that I'd seen recently, not recently, but in my youth. One would be the A-10 quarterfinal beatdown of St. Joe's, where like there was never like a 16-0 run or anything like that. It was just like a constant annihilation throughout the game. That's what happened those last 15 minutes. And Osco Ohio State football game from like 3 years ago, where Ohio State's up like 24 and they end up losing, and had the game gone another 5 minutes, they would have lost by 30. I mean, it was just this momentum that Taylor, not stopping. Taylor.
Wasn't that Taylor Martinez in Nebraska, I believe? Or our buddy DJ Hodge.
It was more like Rex Burkhead just running wild.
But I think our buddy DJ Hodge enjoyed that, Rick.
He did. He text messaged me to inform me that he was enjoying it.
Great. Ohio State football talk. Cool.
Well, hey, there was some Nebraska football talk in there, too. Come on.
Well done, fellas. The listeners are loving that.
All right. So when we look at the... When we look at the stats for this game, one thing that jumps out to me, we talked when we were running down the Butler game about how Xavier looked like they were the better conditioned team down the stretch. This game, Georgetown has no depth in the backcourt. Devontae Smith, Rivera, and Markel Starks played every second of this game. And I think it showed down the stretch. Georgetown was 10 of 14 from three when they hit sort of the apex of their lead. They end the game 10 for 18. They weren't drawing fouls down the stretch. They weren't getting rebounds down the stretch. They were just out of gas. And Xavier just boat raced them when the game got close. I have to say it was just an incredibly impressive close to the game. I don't know. What do you guys see as the big takeaways from this game, other than the topics that we've already talked about?
The Xavier offense is a heck of a lot better than I thought it would be. I mean, that's my biggest takeaway. I mean, I thought they would struggle to score. They don't at all. And while Georgetown's not the greatest defensive team in the world, I mean, they just don't struggle to score at all. And that's amazing to me.
Brian, how much of that would you attribute to the fact that Justin Martin has emerged as a consistent offensive threat this year?
I think a good deal, because last year he was getting open shot after open shot after open shot and missing them. This year he's shooting a 38% clip from three. I mean, that's
starting off. Slow.
Yeah. I mean, when you get that from your three man, who other teams decided not to guard for periods of time, that's a big, big deal.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Martin for sure more in the DePaul game, because he played really well then as well. I guess my biggest takeaway would just be, I mean, we kind of did already hit on this, but the way that they played at the end of the game without Samaje on the floor once again. We saw it in the UC game where they played really well for that stretch, but that was just that atmosphere and everything about that game just almost didn't feel real. Like, as a Xavier fan, I understand that you probably celebrated that one forever, but I'd have to think that now you look back at that game with the way UC's currently playing. And I mean, I know Xavier's playing well too, but I think you look back at that game and say, that was a lot of fun, but that didn't really feel real. And that still might not be real. But when they go and do it again against a team like Georgetown, I think, you know, that's a great sign for this team and the way that it's developed. And I also think it's why we've seen Samaje up his performances as well, because I think there's sort of this burden lifted off his shoulders of, I don't have to carry the whole load and I don't have to force things. I can take good shots. We've seen him go almost entire halves where he's not getting good looks or not getting in position to score easily, and he's just not shooting the ball. He's distributing and getting other guys looks. And I think that's the biggest difference from last year as well, is that he does not have that burden on him to always lead this team in scoring and always force the issue on offense. And that's really helping his decision making and what he's capable of doing, and it's his efficiency on the offensive end.
And that's exactly what Brad Redford told us last week when he was talking about the differences between Samaje last year and this year. So that young man may have a future in the media after all. Samaje, for the record, 18 points in that game, 9 of 11 from the field, or 9 of 12 from the field, I should say. He had one, missed three. Rick, one last question, and then I'll ask Brian a sort of related question. So my question for you, Rick, is As somebody who's been to a lot of these games at CentOS Center, how did the atmosphere rank as compared to other games this year and games in the past? And Brian, what's the best atmosphere you've ever seen at CentOS Center?
I'm going to have to say that that was probably, as far as crowd noise, that was the best atmosphere I've been at a Xavier game. Because, and I think the reason for that was because, you know, in the first half, there's a pretty good vibe usually, and there usually is a decent vibe in the first half of any game because it's usually close enough that the fans are still into it. But a lot of times in these second halves, if you have a 10-point lead or even just a 5-7-point lead for the majority of the half, the crowd sits on their hands and you don't hear them a lot. With this game, they needed that comeback, and it was just shot after shot going in for Xavier. The crowd got so into it. It was loud the entire 20 minutes of that second half, even during timeouts. And it's as loud as I've ever heard the CentOS Center, without question. I do have to say real quick before Brian gets in, is Georgetown's SID was sitting next to me. And I'm not a huge press row etiquette guy. I'm not like the old journalist guy who like gets real pissed off when someone's cheering at press row, though I prefer you don't do it, and I would never do it. But Georgetown's SID was sitting next to me, and I really wouldn't have cared if he cheered. I mean, he works for the school. I'm sure he's excited when they're killing Xavier in the first half. But while Georgetown was just sinking three after three in the first half, he was trying not to cheer, but he was so overcome that he was throwing these. He was doing the silent cheer job right next to me. And like, you've got a little more room where I'm positioned now. Over at the other, on the sideline, it would have been even worse. On the baseline, there's a little more space, but there's not a ton of elbow room. And this dude is throwing vicious fist pumps after each DSR three. And I'm like, man, you're hitting my elbows. Just
I really down. Feel like, Here's the problem. You're saying all this, and I sat next to you on press row for a lot of games last year, and I'm afraid I might have been doing the same stuff.
Yeah. I don't think so. I think we were usually talking during all those things, and you're making off-color comments and things of that nature, so it didn't bother me as much. But this guy, like, never said anything to me, which I would have felt more comfortable if he would have just been like, nice shot or something, you know, but like the way he was like holding it in was just making these fist pumps more and more violent as he went.
Okay. Is that more or less appropriate than our man Ozzy heckling Ted Valentine from press row?
I'd say less appropriate. I like Ozzy heckling referees. I don't really know that Ozzy's a member of the media. Ozzy just is. He's Cincinnati. So I don't think you can hold him to the same standards that you hold other humans.
He wears black shoes and white socks. You can't do that.
Oh, people.
Snow, best atmosphere at CentOS Center you can remember.
I'll give you a top two. Number one for me was the Jordan Crawford crosstown shootout, the near two brawl game. Double overtime. That was just amazing. Devontae Smith Rivera almost and Gary Harris almost committed on the spot, and Gary Harris, I don't believe, was even at the game. His father was.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was just ridiculous. And then also the second Elite Eight year against Tennessee, they ended up losing, but it was a heck of a game. And I just remember the atmosphere being ridiculous.
That was one of the best. Absolutely. I totally agree with you. That was one of the best atmospheres at CentOS I can remember. And that was a noon game on a weekend in December with the students on break. And it was a ridiculous atmosphere. The one I would bring up is the George Washington game, David West senior year, when West tipped in the basket and there was like the 10-minute review at the end of the game before they determined that the shot counted and Xavier had won. I just remember that being pretty incredible. But all right, fellas. So
before we go to the DePaul game, of course, the number one question I got about this game was not anything to do with the game. It was more to do with why Jalen Reynolds didn't play. So I have to ask, do you guys believe that Chris Mack is secretly scheming against the over-under that we set for Jalen Reynolds' technicals and just not playing him as much this year?
It's very possible. I think
he listens. I got to be honest.
Trust me, coaches read and listen to message boards as judged by my text messages at times. And I think he's against you, Rick. I think he is.
I really do. I like, I'm not kidding, because, you know, people are really worried about this and everything. And I think you guys are being selfish. You're worried about development for the team and wins in the future. You got to think about this podcast and the over under that we set. There is no way that he's going to get over 8.5 if Mac does not play him a little bit more this year to get that second technical.
Yeah, maybe Mac. Maybe Mac's got action on things. You never know.
He might have gotten down. That could be it.
Can I mention, by the way, if we're talking about maybe hypothetical gambling, that I think Xavier has covered the last nine numbers in their games. Just throwing that out there. Ooh, all right.
There's some guys on the board losing money, right?
Well,
would they be losing money or making money?
Losing, you know, against Xavier.
Oh, okay.
I don't understand the logic, but whatever. Let's move on to the DePaul game. Monday, Allstate Arena, Rosemont, Illinois against DePaul. Musketeers led 32 at halftime, and then the second half was kind of a slog. Guys, your takeaway from this game, I mean, obviously Samaje Christen is the story, right? With 27 points, 9 of 12 from the field, 9 of 11 from the foul line.
I didn't see the game, but the box score was real impressive.
Well, thank you for that input. That's why we bring you on the podcast, for that kind of expert analysis.
No one gives analysis like these.
I will say, Christen was incredibly dominant in that first half. He just destroyed their defense there for all 20 minutes.
Rick, were there any questions asked of Xavier players about Samaje's play, maybe in the post-game press conference?
Yeah.
So you want to play at this point?
Yeah, we do have to play this question real here. I don't know who this guy is, so I don't really feel bad making fun of him. If it was a Cincinnati reporter, we'd probably still do this, but I'd feel a little worse about it. So, anyway, this is some guy from DePaul asking Isaiah Fillmore about Samaje Christen's play. I personally feel that Isaiah did a good job of handling it.
When Samaje is having a game like that, and do you find yourself, watching yourself have to pull this shit, do you find yourself a little bit, or when he's doing that in the first half?
I mean, I guess. I see him doing practice every day, so to me, it's not really being in awe. Something that, quite frankly, that's something I expect. Not to that extent, but I mean, when I looked up and he had, 20 at half or something like that, that's something that I know he's capable of, We hang out all the time. We're in the gym all the time. So I know what he can do, and he's definitely capable of that at any point in time that he puts his mind to it.
So I'll just say, I think Isaiah Fillmore was as stunned as we were at that question at first, but I thought he really composed himself quickly and actually gave
a
ridiculous question.
Can we say that there was used by the reporter and not Rick or I? So if, the higher ups at Scout want to censor the podcast, they can, it's not our fault. We're just in the reporting business. We're not trying to add any of our own profanity or so forth.
Right. But that being said, I think the story of this game for me wasn't Samaje, because I almost feel like Fillmore at this point. We've seen him do this so much. I've known this was coming. We've all talked about the potential for him getting drafted and everything else. Obviously, we kind of expected at some point things would start clicking and start doing this, and that's clearly happening right now. So at this point, I'm not surprised when I see him score 25 on a ridiculously absurd efficient performance. Justin Martin had another impressive game. He was 4 of 6 from the field, 3 of 5 from beyond the arc, 7 of 9 from the free throw line, 7 rebounds, 2 steals. It was the 6th straight game in double figures. And I go back to, the last time Snow was on this podcast. I think we all remember this. This will go down as probably one of the legendary Dane and Victory segments on this show here. You mentioned Martin. Here we kind of talked about this with Brandon Randolph. Here's the tougher question. Snow, Dan, both of you guys, Justin Martin, We've seen now a great 10 minutes in that Evansville game to finish off. He hits a couple big threes in this game, plays phenomenal at both ends of the court, really got after it defensively, was completely locked in, rebounded well. Is there some, and we've seen flashes from him before, but is there a chance that this is like a Michael Hawkins type situation or a Lionel Chalmers where last part of this guy's senior year, the light finally goes on and he finally understands how to play hard and maximize his potential?
Snow, I'll let you take this one.
It's going to take more than a game and a half for me. I'll put it that way. I mean, at some point in time, you are what you are. Justin Martin's like 32 years old by now. He's not pulling me off of a game and a half.
I completely agree. Is there a chance, in your opinion, though? I'm not ready to say it by any means. Is there a chance that Justin could do this in your
opinion? Oh, no.
And I guess there's a chance I could hook up with Kate Upton tonight. I just don't think either's
there. No, there's not.
Stop the fight. Stop the fight.
Come on. Just not fair.
Justin Stop Martin the fight.
Better chances. A legendary segment on this podcast, obviously, but we have to revisit it because Justin Martin is playing so well still. This is, again, six straight games in double figures, and four of the six, it's been 15 or more. Have we changed our minds? I mean, at this point, he's as consistent as anybody not named Samaje Christen for this team.
Hold on, Rick. Let's get back to something because you asked the question. You said, and I quote, is this a Michael Hawkins, Lionel Chalmers situation where a guy late in his senior year blows up? I had no choice but to answer no, because Justin Martin's only a junior.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. I realized that when I was listening like the second and third time as well.
That is snow with the wind.
That is splitting hairs.
Yeah.
Hey, at the end of the day, you either win or lose. I win.
That's actually, it's how much equipment you come home with. It really doesn't matter whether you win or lose or not, but that's besides the point. Snow, what do you say now about where Justin Martin is and what he means to this team, though, in all seriousness?
You have to give Marty credit. I mean, he's probably the number two scoring option right now, and I never thought I would ever say this, but he's playing good defense. And they can rely on Justin Martin not only to make shots, but to make the right play, to guard his guy, to not foul. You got to give the kid credit. I mean, he's playing his butt off. There's no question about that.
Rick, the thing that I think about is last year when we would talk about Xavier, we would talk about, especially after the first Butler game, if you remember that, when Brad Stevens came to the mic and he said, yeah, Jeff Robinson is the X factor for Xavier, because if he plays to his potential, he elevates the rest of the team. And Jeff Robinson didn't do that on a consistent basis last year. Justin Martin is kind of that guy for this team. When you look at, you know, Christen is a given. Stainbrook, you know what you're getting. Fillmore, you know what you're getting. But Justin Martin is the guy that can push this team over the top, I think. And when you look at the way Xavier's played, 10 of their last 11 wins, the one loss being a game at Creighton where they played really well and just ran into the buzzsaw to end all buzzsaws. I mean, I think I'm really impressed by the way he's played over the last month. And if he continues over the next 2 months, Xavier's going to have a real good year and have a real good chance to advance in the NCAA tournament.
I think when you look at Martin and Stainbrook and what they kind of have meant to each other, it's really interesting, because I think if Martin wasn't scoring the way he is, then Stainbrook would score more. But at the same time, I do think there's been games where Stainbrook's tried to get it going and has struggled to score inside. I go back to the Georgetown game. I thought he got a tough whistle in that game. I didn't think they were calling much at all, but they weren't calling much at all at either end, and he was just happening to let it affect him a whole lot because he was expecting the contact and then trying to
Before you go any further, Rick, Matt Stainbrook and Justin Martin, that's a buddy comedy waiting to be filmed.
It's like Step Brothers. I could see
they should be. No, I think they should be. I think they should be cops. They should be partners on the beat. But
I don't think that's a good idea. I don't want Justin Martin handling handling a gun.
Well, later we can talk about We can talk about Tori and Graham later, and maybe about.
Dan, come on.
Some people get hungry. What can you?
Or we could talk about. Or we could talk about Kellen Winslow, I guess, too. Because, well, never mind. Let's talk about Stainbrook for a second, Rick. Is there any cause for concern? Because he's had two straight, kind of subpar games by his standards so far this year.
No, and I go back and going back to what I was talking about before, I think it's interesting when you look at those two, because if Martin wasn't scoring the way he was, they would need more from Stainbrook, and I think he would provide that. But at the same time, a big reason Martin's scoring the way he is because of the way he's been able to play off of Stainbrook. I mean, I can count at least three times, just calling back to times where Stainbrook's caught it on that post and he's looked cross court right to Martin on that opposite wing, wide open. There's not a lot of big guys who are as patient as Stainbrook is and as good at seeing that opening, but he seems to be ready for that every single time, and teams haven't started respecting Justin Martin as much as I think they will going forward with the way he's been shooting the ball, but he's gotten a lot of open looks because of the way that Matt Stainbrook passes the ball out of the post, and it's really helped him. So I think it's funny when you kind of look at how those two have impacted each other's seasons.
Rick, why did Xavier struggle so much in the second half, in your opinion?
I thought Samaje actually summed this up perfectly after the game.
Talk about the difference in the first half and the second half. Were they doing something different there to pressure you or what?
I think the first half we just came out, we was more ready to play. Second half, I think we kind of relaxed. I know at halftime, Coach Mack, he kind of got on us about it because he seen a couple guys in the locker room smiling, and he just thought we took our foot off the gas. That's all I think it was. We just relaxed. We got too casual with everything. So we'll work on it, get better at it. Next game.
My favorite word in there that he used is casual. Coach Mack always uses the word cool. We can't cool our way through, you know, things. And I thought that's what you saw, is that there are two things. One, it's tough when you get out of attack mode and your goal now is to start running your offense, running clock. It is tough to break a press because this team's going all out to turn you over, and they know you're not going to score at the other end because you're going to pull it out. So it allows them to really sell out for that steal. So that is a tough thing to do, one. And two, Xavier didn't handle that tough situation well. You're going to find yourself in tough spots. You're going to find yourselves in traps. But Xavier was also helping DePaul out by just throwing the ball away, being careless with it, acting like, hey, we've got a big lead here. And, you know, they played the score, to use another cliche, most of that second half. But at the same time, this team battled, still won by double digits on the road. The game never really felt like it was in question. I know it got down to about 7 there a couple times in the second half. But ultimately, Xavier stayed in control that whole time. And my big takeaway from this game was just that this team, we were worried about how they would look once they got on the road. That was kind of the last big question is, okay, they've gone on a big winning streak. They've won a lot of games here. All of them have been at the Cintas Center. How are they going to look once they get away from home in the Big East? Are they going to fold? Are they going to continue to be able to score the ball? Will they really struggle to shoot? And they've gotten off to quick starts in these games, both against DePaul and at Creighton. They've shot the ball really well in those games. There's been plenty of offense. I think that's the big takeaway is this team looks very much like the same team on the road as they do at home.
Yeah. Oh, good. Here's my thing, Dan, and this is kind of a drop the mic situation, but if the biggest concern is the game got to within 7 in the second half, things were going pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, let's just be real here. Not a great, and on the list of concerns for, you know, like a college basketball team, the home team cutting the lead to 7, not real high.
Right. Well, let's sort of take the temperature of this team at this point and talk about where things stand and where they're going. X, as we said at the top of the show, 15-4, 5-1, tied for second in the Big East. They're 28th in the Pomeroy rankings. Their RPI is extremely high. I'm sorry, I'm trying to get that tab up on my computer. I believe they're in the top 20 of the RPI right now, 23 actually. And if you're a one of my favorite websites, and you know I'm a huge dork about these things statistically, but is RPI Forecast, which tells you what a team's final RPI is likely to be depending on their regular season record. And even if you stick Xavier at 6-6 in their last 12 games of the regular season, they're looking at being in a very solid position to make the NCAA tournament at about a 35-36 RPI. So guys, I mean, how would you assess where this team is at this point compared to your preseason projections and maybe what you thought about them after Atlantis? Start with Brian, maybe.
You know, for me, they're a little bit better, and I'm not sure if they're better as much as some of the teams in the Big East I don't think are quite as good as I thought they'd be, notably Georgetown and Marquette. So I thought Xavier would be in the 4-5-6 range for the Big East. Now I think they're clearly 1-2-3. But in terms of how they're playing, maybe slightly better, but I thought this was a really good team when I saw them in preseason workouts.
Yeah, you were very high on this team, I think, early in the season, in comparison to Rick and I, who I think were a little bit more conservative on what we thought. Rick, where do you see them right now?
I think Brian kind of hit the nail on the head. Everyone had them around that 6-7 mark, but at the time when we recorded our preview podcast, I know we even talked to Shannon Russell. We kind of all said that there would be a chance between 4-7, anywhere from 4-7, we could possibly see. And as it turns out, a couple of these teams aren't as good as Brian stated. I think this Providence game is going to give Xavier the opportunity to say they're definitely the third best team in this conference, and on any given night they can be the best or the second best, depending on how well Creighton's shooting the ball and how well Villanova's playing. So, you know, they're right there in that top three, as Snow mentioned, and they're definitely a tournament team at this point unless someone gets injured or they really have some type of collapse down the stretch, but I don't see that happening.
Well, Rick, there's a couple things that give me pause, I guess, when you look at this team. First of all, if you look at Pomeroy's ratings, he has a line item for conference strength of schedule. And as of right now, Xavier's strength of schedule in their conference games, the six conference games, is 9th out of 10, which actually kind of makes some sense when you think about the fact that St. John's, who was preseason predicted to be in the middle of the league, is 0-5 in conference. When you think that Butler, who was also predicted to be, you know, 6th or 7th or 8th, is 1-6, DePaul 2-5, and Marquette and Georgetown, two teams that I think preseason, when people talked about this league, they talked about the top three teams being Marquette, Georgetown, and Creighton. Well, Marquette's 3-3, Georgetown's 3-4, and so a lot of those teams that we thought coming into Cintas Center early in the season would be competitive for the Big East title have not looked the part so far. And so I think there is some cause to think, well, this team hasn't quite made their bones yet. I mean, they've only played 2 road games out of 6 to start out, and they've got a lot of tough road trips left to go. For me, this Providence game is a huge bellwether for the rest of the season, because Providence has been one of the few teams in the sort of middle class of the Big East that has outperformed preseason expectations. Even with some of the personnel that they've lost this year, they have done a really nice job this season. You look at their resume, they're sitting at 14-5. They're 4-2 in Big East play. In Big East play, their two losses were they lost at home to Seton Hall in double overtime on New Year's Eve, and then they got boat raced away to Villanova. But since then, they've beaten Georgetown at home, they've beaten St. John's away in double overtime as well, and then they hammered Creighton in their home facility, and then beat Butler 65-56 last night. In terms of their resume on the whole, they have a nice win on a neutral floor against LaSalle. They played Kentucky reasonably well, losing by 14 at Rupp Arena. They played Massachusetts very close, losing in overtime. So their non-conference schedule, they've shown that they can beat some pretty good teams. And this seems like a team that's been improving as conference play has gone on. Is this, when you think about this game on Saturday afternoon, I mean, is this one of the tougher road games that Xavier will play in the conference?
Yeah, it's definitely one of the tougher road games. I mean, I think the ones that are tougher, you know, Creighton, they've already been to, and then you've got Villanova as well. Other than that, I say this is probably next in line as a tough road game. For me, when I look at this game, the biggest key is going to be keeping Providence off the offensive glass and defending them without fouling. I think D. Davis can make it tough enough on Bryce Cotton. I mean, he's really good. He's not a great shooter, but he makes big shots and makes a lot of tough shots. They play slow. They've got pretty good efficiency numbers, though, on both offense and defense. I think it comes back to, can Xavier rebound consistently and get stops on the defensive end, and can they defend them without fouling on the road? And you know, I mean, you don't think you'll get an unfair whistle, but obviously it's always tougher when you go on the road to get calls. So I think you have to worry about that a little bit as well.
Best foul shooting team in the country, yeah, as of 80%
today. 80% from the line, basically, 79.9.
I'll tell you what, those foul shooting drills that Ed Cooley does, Chris Mack needs to learn.
No kidding, man.
So beyond Bryce Cotton, the second most productive player for them is LaDante Henton, who I think Xavier fans will recall because he was a commit to Brian Gregory at Dayton, right?
Yep.
And what can we expect from LaDante Henton in this game? What does he bring to the table, Brian?
Undersized junkyard dog. Just kind of one of those kids. He's 6'7". He's not athletic, but he finds a way to get stuff done. Can step out and hit the 18, 19 footer. Scores. He rebounds. Just kind of a do-it-all kid who, you know, overachieves, if you will, relative to his physical skills.
Yeah, he's a tough guy. He reminds you a little bit of like a C.J. Anderson with maybe a little bit more of a gifted physique and body. So he's taller and everything. But
how's his Twitter feed?
Not nearly as on Deem.
One thing that sticks out to me when you look at their sort of Ken Pom profile is he's got a statistic called effective height where he compares each team's size, I suppose.
12th, aren't they?
Yeah, they're 8th, actually. Oh, 4.3 inches taller than the average team at whatever position. So, and you look at the guys that get the majority of their minutes. Cotton's a 6'1 point guard. Kadeem Batts, 6'9. Tyler Harris, the transfer from North Carolina State, at 6'9. Henton, 6'6. Josh Fortune, who's sort of their shooting guard, 6'5. And then they got Carson, I'm not even going to try.
DeRozier's
7 foot substitute. He's a transfer from Wake Forest. I have to say, I think Ed Cooley's done a nice job with this group, given that they lost Chris Dunn. They lost Lee Goldsboro, a guy that they thought they were going to get a lot of minutes out of. So I think Providence has positioned themselves pretty well to potentially be the fourth Big East team in line for a bid to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, their average height, they're 12th. That's what I was remembering. Xavier's average height is 130th, for those wondering.
And this podcast average height is 1 billionth.
I'm not the tallest kid in America.
No, I'm by some distance the tallest host of this podcast, and I'm 5'11".
Well, first, before we get into a few recruiting tidbits, I just want to hit on one overall thing. Kind of the negative, I guess, if you can say there's been one for this team over this last stretch, has been the defense. It's not the defense we've been used to over the last 2 years. And part of that is when you're scoring more points and you're playing at a faster pace, you're going to give up more points. But they're not playing as well. Brad Redford talked about it on the last podcast. Snow, what have you seen on that end? In your opinion, is it fixable? Is it something this team will improve at? Or is it just sometimes you're going to do a little give and take with the personnel you put on the floor, and this personnel, especially with Stainbrook being a little slower, isn't as good defensively as they were with someone like Travis Taylor last year, who could obviously defend ball screens really well all the way out to midcourt?
I think the first thing they need to do is not play Creighton again, because that'll hurt your defensive numbers.
Yeah, makes it
unfortunately, they do. But go on.
But I think it's – I don't think it's that big a deal. You know, certainly you'd rather not give up points than give up points, but sometimes team makes shots against you. Sometimes they don't. I think Xavier's been solid from what I've seen. Now, granted, I haven't seen every game, but I don't think it's a huge issue that should alarm the world.
That leads into another question. Actually, Brian, I think this is something you posted to the message board maybe a year ago, but it stuck with me, that you said that coaches always say defense wins championships, but your point was no, elite offensive teams are better equipped in college basketball to win because of the depressed scoring atmosphere that we're in over the last 5 to 6 years. Do you still think that's the case?
Absolutely. At the end of the game, at the end of the day, perfect offense beats perfect defense 100 times out of 100, and there's no way around it. You take a look at Devontae Smith-Rivera hit the last bucket Georgetown got, which might have also been the last time they hit the rim, with about 6 minutes to go, hit a fadeaway 15-footer over D. Davis. There is not a thing on earth D. Davis could have done better on that play.
There's not a thing on earth. There's not a thing on earth Anthony Davis could have done better on that play.
I mean, at the end of the day, if a kid makes a shot, he makes a shot, and offense will always beat defense.
So now, another reason you are the best in the business is because you were at Flying to the Hoop this weekend. There were a couple Xavier targets there. Issa Ahmad, definitely a guy that's emerging in 2015 that they're really in on. Combo four, or really a four type guy, but a face up four at 6'7". What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, think a little bit more skilled version of Fillmore, I guess would be the best way of putting it. He's someone Xavier offered. Chris Mack went up and watched him in the fall and offered him on the spot. He really likes him. Super skilled kid, can shoot threes, and then also will rebound. Not a great athlete like Fillmore, but you know, someone Xavier likes in that class. As we've discussed before, there's no pressing need in 2015, so you're just kind of looking for a good player, and he's someone they like. He's from Shaker Heights, which obviously the Cleveland area is not too far from Cincinnati, and that's just kind of one of the major guys that they're really going to be focusing on going forward, I believe.
Another guy that they have offered in the 2016 class, a shooter with some size, Seth Towns. How did he look, and what can you tell us about him?
Yeah, two of Xavier's top 2016 targets were there. One was Seth Towns, the other is Tervell Beck. Towns from the Columbus area, Beck from the Cleveland area. And they're both kind of 4-3, 3-4 type players with athleticism that can make shots, that are skilled, kind of tough. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, kind of there's like six of those guys in Ohio right now in that class. And it's just who's going to emerge as better than the other. What's the pecking order going to be? Towns played okay. Beck's team got the break speed off of him by Huntington Prep, so it was unfair to judge him. But Towns had a solid game. I want to see him mix it up a little bit more, maybe get a little tougher. But, you know, he's solid. He's got an offer. He's someone Xavier's watching very closely.
Yeah, I watched I watched all of Towns' game at the specific tournament this summer. I can't remember which one it was at. But Coach Steele was there watching him a lot, I know, as well. And from what I saw is just he had a really smooth shot. I would agree with you that, you know, you'd like to see him go in and mix it up with his size and athleticism a little bit more inside and get to the rim a little bit. But he really shot the ball well from deep and had a smooth-looking jumper. For a kid who's 6'6", 6'7", that's a pretty nice skill set.
Guys, I know we don't like to talk about these things, and it's really unfortunate. We got the news this week about Kamal Richards blowing out his knee, out for the season. Everyone's aware that going into next season, Xavier's two scholarships over as of right now. Is there any indication as to how that is going to be resolved? Has Samaje Christen's emergence over the last 3 weeks changed you guys' opinion that he might be coming back? I mean, it's certainly to me, when I watch the way he's played in Big East play, I see a guy who's tracking the NBA lottery, and we're going to be lucky to have him for five more home games. I mean, do you guys get a read on where things are going as we head into the offseason?
The one thing with Samaje that a lot of people probably don't know, and I don't know if you necessarily say you credit the Xavier staff or you credit whoever, but right now Samaje's circle is his mother, his high school coach, Jason Smith from Brewster, Travis Steele, and Chris Mack. Like that's who's going to be involved in this decision. And no one else is going to have a plan. No one else is going to have a say. That's it. You know, some of the other fine citizens of the city of Cincinnati have been cut out of this decision-making process. Right now, Samaje is not a big forward thinker in this regard. He's not worried about the NBA. Samaje loves the city of Cincinnati. Right now, if you were to ask Samaje, he's coming back. He doesn't have to make that decision right now, though. And if he's told he's a lottery pick, not only will he leave, he won't be allowed to return. You know, at some point in time as a coach, you tell the parent, we're going to look out for the best interest of your kid. And if the kid's a lottery pick and you tell him to come back, you're not looking out for his best interest. But right now, he's not a lottery pick. And, you know, money's made in March, and we'll see what happens then.
Although I do believe Chad Ford, ESPN's draft insider, the latest projections he just put out had Samaje at 23rd in the first round. So not a lottery pick, but moving up. Most everyone considers him a first round pick at this point when it comes to projections. I know Draft Express has him there as well. So it's certainly a possibility. But I do agree with Brian that in a lot of respects, Samaje's life is as good as it's ever been right now. He's not, I don't think he's as anxious to leave it as people thought he might be before the season started. But at the same time, if he plays himself into the position, then like we said on the last podcast, it's going to be a win-win for Dodger fans. You know, it's going to be to the point where he leads them on that run to where he's a no-brainer, has to go to the NBA draft. A lot of times that happens with a big run in the postseason during March Madness. And if that happens, I think most Xavier fans would say it's well worth it to get him for just this year if he takes Xavier on a run into the tournament. So, you know, I think it'll work itself out just fine. One other thing on the recruiting front, Kyle Ahrens, Brian, is a guy, another Ohio kid, who is being recruited heavily by Xavier. He's out right now. He's got a small fracture and a little bone below his knee, I believe is what it is. But
I believe he told me tibia and a fractured fibula. Dan, you're the smart one. Does that sound right?
Is that yeah.
No,
that's that sounds really the leg. That actually sounds really serious. And thank you, Dr. Broering, for updating us on the human skeletal system there.
No problem. That's what I do.
He was adamant he'll be back by the spring though, and his father confirmed those thoughts.
Yes. Snow, what do you think about him as a prospect? I think personally, if he wasn't playing on the same AAU team as Luke Kennard, he would be receiving a lot more hype, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, he's really good. You know, he's starting to get Big Ten offers, and we'll see what happens with him. You know, in that class, let's be honest, Xavier's brought in J.P. McCura, who will be a freshman or would be a sophomore when the 2015 kid would be there. Trayvon Blewett would be a sophomore. Remy Abel, senior. Miles Davis, junior. Brandon Randolph, junior. It's going to be really tough to bring a wing in.
True.
And that wing, if he does come
Edmund
in,
Sumner,
you're going to look at
Edmund
him kind
Sumner
of
fun. Would be a sophomore, too.
Yeah,
point guard, but.
But, I mean, it's just going to be really tough to sell a wing in that class. But, you know, what they decided is they have a couple kids like Marcus Sheffield and Kyle Ahrens, and they're going to recruit both of them. They recruited them before they got Lewitt and McCura, and they're going to stay the course, if you will, recruiting them. And, you know, they're in a decent position with both. It's just, you know, how do you necessarily sell that to a recruit? It's going to be tough.
Right. Yeah, no question. And then finally, they've been looking at point guard prospects. We've talked about there's not a lot of elite point guard prospects in this class. So guys are maybe being recruited a little higher than they should be. James Bolden, definitely one of the guys benefiting from that. He's getting a lot of looks. West Virginia has been in a couple times to watch him already this season. Xavier's been around a couple times to watch him as well. He has told Evan Daniels that Butler and X stand out to him, are kind of the two schools on top. You know, I think he's definitely a guy that Xavier likes and will continue to recruit. I really like his ability to make tough shots and the fact that he shoots it well from three off the dribble. That's a skill set that not a lot of young guards possess. And he has obviously a great handle. I just, at this point, I think he's more of a 5'10 lead scorer than he is a 5'10 point guard. And I don't know that he has the elite athleticism and quickness to get by guys at the next level that are bigger than him. So that's going to be an issue going forward. He's not making guys a lot better yet, but he is definitely a talented shot maker. So he's got a lot of upside there.
Yeah, as of right now, I would say don't count on James Bolden being in this class.
I would agree with that at this point.
What, looking at the 2015 class, guys, first of all, how many scholarships do you think X will have? And while you guys are doing that research, I'll talk for a couple minutes. What positions do you think X will target for that class? It seems like they probably are going to need at that point another. They're probably going to need a point guard in the 2015 class. Although, as you say, it's kind of a weak class in that regard. I mean, where does X go? Because obviously, I don't think wings are going to be a priority with McCura and Blewett both coming in next year.
I'd say expect the working number to be 3 to answer your first question for this class. Expect them to recruit for 3 spots.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that as well. Right now, they got 11 kids on the books for that class, but the odds of all 11 being there are probably not very good. And no, I'm not counting Samaje Christen in that 11 for those of you with a rolling depth chart at your house.
Wait, so I would you have a rolling 3. Depth chart? I have one on my wall. I update it daily.
So I'm saying 3 to work with. I would think they're going to look for a kind of combo forward. Maybe more of a Justin Tillman type guy who they missed out on in this class, because Mackinday London, more of a finesse 4. I think they're going to look for more of a rugged kind of butt kicker. I think they would kind of like another center and then a point guard.
Well, talking about recruiting, of course, the 2014 class, who's already signed and delivered, has just been – I mean, all these guys seem to be off the charts this year. Brian, I know, Trayvon Blewett's in your area. What have you seen from him this high school season?
Well, me being the fine reporter that I am who does all of his research, he would tell you I've never seen Trayvon Blewett this season. But I will do that a couple times in the next few weeks. That said, he's putting up stupid numbers. I mean, just absolutely stupid. And he's doing it against elite competition. So, I mean, the kid, he doesn't look good when he walks into the gym. You're not scared of him. But when he steps on that court, that's a bad boy. And he can just get buckets.
Yeah, that's Rick, all that needs to be said about that.
Rick, I seem to recall Chad Brendel, your guy that writes for the UC site, compared Blewett to Sean Kilpatrick, didn't he, after the Crosstown Shootout?
Yeah, just kind of in the sense that neither one's necessarily like an elite NBA prospect type athlete, but both are just, really, really good scorers. Blewett's a better shooter than Kilpatrick was at the same stage.
Kilpatrick's 42 years old also. Right. So,
and I do give Sean Kilpatrick a lot.
Hey, Trayvon's no spring chicken either now.
I do give Sean Kilpatrick a lot of credit for working himself into becoming a better player and a better athlete. But yeah, I do see some similarities in what he was saying. But Trayvon's, he's a talented scorer without question.
Jordan Adams at UCLA. Jordan Adams at UCLA. That's the guy to think when thinking Trayvon Blewett.
Snow, I can't stay up late enough to watch Pac-10 basketball, so I have no idea what you're talking about.
I'm just trying to make you better, Dan.
Fair enough. All right, fellas. Any non-basketball topics you want to discuss? Brian Snow.
I think the NFL draft really intrigues me. If you're the GM of the Cincinnati Bengals, what are you looking for in the first round? Because you've got to assume the top-level quarterbacks will be off the board. Mettenberger with one ACL would be a reach at that point. Is a guy like a Darqueus Denard, a Ha-Ha Clinton Dix at safety? What are you going for, Dan, in the first round?
My two picks would be either Denard or Carlos Hyde.
Here's my thing with Carlos Hyde. If we were going to rank the 22 positions on a football field, which would rank 22nd in terms of importance? It'd be running back.
Yeah, that's.
I wouldn't use the first round.
That's my.
Thing. I wouldn't use the first round pick on a running back.
Well, fair enough.
The second round. That's the only problem.
Well, I mean, then you get the dude from Boston College. I don't think the drop off's that big.
Yeah, I'm concerned about the kid from Boston College because he strikes me as having Chris Perry disease, which is way too many carries in college. The one thing that Hyde has going for him is that Herb
and Fickell before him didn't wear that kid out while he was in school. I would have concerns. Suspended. Well, yeah, perfect.
Good.
Exactly. If Denard is there at that point and they can actually get a lockdown corner, the guy they thought they were getting in Dre Kirkpatrick, who's been a complete bust. Yeah, that would be fine.
Yeah. My top choice would be corner, then safety probably. And then if not that, if there's an offensive lineman that they really like at that position, I'm never against that, because they're going to be losing Anthony Collins because they won't be able to re-sign that dude. He's way too good this offseason. So I think grooming another young stud backup for the offensive line would be great, because Anthony Collins has been huge to this team's success the last 2 years with injuries.
Yeah, so, if Cyrus Quantra is available, I would be okay with that. For sure.
Snow, do you draft a quarterback this year? And if so, who would be the guy you target?
I would love Zach Mettenberger. Second or third round, absolutely would love it. That dude is an NFL passer.
Rick?
I'm with him, because I don't think there's going to be anyone that's worth taking in the first round when they're going to pick. I think the elite guys will be gone. I think the guys left, like Snow talked about, you'd probably like Mettenberger the best out of any of them, and he'd be a reach with one ACL at that point. Snow said that perfectly, so I agree with him. Second round, third round, he'd be great. Other than that, I don't want to see them go quarterback with this first round pick.
I don't think there's going to be a guy worth taking in the first round either. But my point is, they've got to draft a quarterback this year, don't they?
Yeah, I think they do at some point, if they can get a guy they really like in the second round, or pretty much anybody that's the next best in the third round.
Well, I'm just saying, I remember, you know, when Burfict came out, the scouting combine, they said, this guy's undraftable. He drops out of the draft, the Bengals get him, and now he's a Pro Bowler. And I see the same thing written about Taj Boyd. So if that guy's available on the second day of the draft.
The difference is Taj Boyd is being written about that because he's struggling to play, not because he's crazy. Or they think he's crazy. That was the issue with Perfect. It wasn't an ability question. It was a, you know, intangibles question.
Yeah, and there's no thinking about it. That dude was crazy. crazy.
Well, I don't know. Snow, you were at the playoff game. So was I. I think Rick, you made the sensible decision and didn't go, right?
Why would you go to that?
I don't have a good answer for that.
First of all, I would never set myself up for what you set yourself up for in that situation, because as a Bengals fan, which you guys ribbed me for not understanding being a Bengals fan a few weeks ago on this very podcast, but as a Bengals fan, you should be expecting a letdown in that situation. So why you would trek out in terrible weather to get yourself feeling horrible and probably drunk and extremely cold to be let down like that, I just don't understand. But the other part of this is I go to one NFL game a year at this point. I go to one during the season because I like the vibe. There's something about supporting the team and going to the stadium that's enjoyable. So I do that as a fan. But the NFL experience is way too good at your house. First of all, I enjoy Twitter way too much during NFL games. It completely enhances the experience. Second of all, if you can have a giant big screen plasma TV for less than $600 these days, I mean, they're selling 60 inches for $600 now during these Black Friday sales. Everyone's got a 50 inch or better in their house. So I don't see how you would want to go to a game as opposed to watch HD in 50+ inches with instant replay, cold beer and food at your disposal for free. It just, the NFL experience at the stadium is not good, and that's the only issue with the NFL product at this point.
Rick, let the record show Like, Rick, let the record show that was an impressive rant, though nothing close to your toughness rant. I think me and Dan dozed off halfway in between that. But I will say...
No, Ed, that was actually the opposite of a toughness rant, because what Rick basically espoused there was the opposite of toughness.
Yeah.
He embraced absolutely on every level the opposite of toughness there. Vince Lombardi would just have shook, he'd have shaken his head and walked away from you at that point.
I'm all about comfort. I'm all about comfort and technology and entertainment. And the experience for NFL football is better at your house than going to the stadium. It just is.
I kind of have to agree with that.
No, I agree with Rick. However, I had to do my civic duty and help the sellout, and I bought tickets. I'm a true American.
Well, I got mine for free, so I mean, I'm part of the problem.
No question. In so many more ways than just that, by the way.
Well, that is probably fair. By the way, I consumed more popcorn at the Georgetown game than Rick Smith's at Musketeer Madness.
No chance.
You remember watching this? Okay.
First of all, you're being confused, because it's just like, have you ever seen a basketball in Rick Smith's hands? It looks like a mini ball. Like, I mean, it's tiny. You know how much popcorn he was actually scooping up with each handful that he was shoveling down bottom of fist first? I mean, that was an unbelievable way to eat the popcorn, first of all. His technique was absolutely flawless. But where you're being confused is that the amount of popcorn looked small because it was in his giant-ass hands. That's where you're being
confused. Okay, that might be true, but I blame the vendors at the Cintas Center. Because we walk into the Georgetown game. I went to the game with my sister. We had a couple before the game. We walk in, we get a couple beers at the concession stand, and I said, oh, some pop.
The way.
They do now. Nice. Yeah. Ah, some delicious buttery popcorn. This will be great. So I order a thing of popcorn, and they bring it to me, and the thing was the size of a barrel. I've never seen a larger container of popcorn in my life. So the two of us carry it, one with each hand, up to our seats. And during the game, the entire first half of the game, we're just shoveling our hand in, and it looked like the drunk dude at the Washington State game that was just pouring it into his mouth. It was the biggest thing of popcorn I've ever seen in my life, but it was delicious. And anyone, by the way, that contests whether or not buttery popcorn is a good idea at a basketball game is an idiot, because it's delicious and it's fantastic. But
so it is a good idea is what you're saying.
Oh, it was a great idea, except I felt terrible after the game.
How much did that bad boy set you back? That
$4.
Oh, what a deal. Are you kidding me?
$4 for 17? Yeah, for 17 tons of popcorn. I mean,
I'm going to make my way up to the concession stand before the next game.
Nah, you probably.
No, you're not. You're too cheap. You're going to eat your city barbecue.
You'll make your way back to U.S. Bank Arena so you can get a big red.
Yeah, that was awesome. The only place in America that you can still get a big red is.
I did not tell this story, and I'll do it real quick now. Before the Crosstown shootout, Rick had helped me get a media credential for that. So I'm down in the media room at U.S. Bank Arena, which is, as you would expect, a dump.
Dan,
and
don't lie to the people. Don't be humble about this. You get a media credit because you're a damn good podcaster. That's why.
And well, that's the only one I've gotten all year, so I can't be that good. But in any case, the cooler in there was full of all of the beverages provided at U.S. Bank Arena, and it included all of these colas that went extinct in like 1975.
Dude, and that had like to be was, for like the original Cyclones season, and they just
we're
sell out every game, so they stocked up on RC Cola,
RC and Big Red, I saw both. And I just wanted to be known that I saw both Whit Babcock, the athletic director at UC, and Greg Christopher, the athletic director at Xavier, come in there, look at the cooler, and spend at least 90 seconds looking for something that they were willing to drink and walking out with a water.
The Hawaiian punch just didn't do it for Whit.
Yeah, the Hawaiian punch just didn't do it, I guess.
Hold on. Getting back to another one of Rick's epic rants on the Rant podcast that he so glowingly put forward a few weeks ago. We haven't heard any meetings regarding Xavier UC in the Crosstown shootout, have we?
No. Have you?
Yeah, exactly. I tried to friggin' tell you.
Well played, Snow. Well played.
All right.
I don't have anything for that. That's it. That's the end of the podcast.
Before we finish tonight, I just wanted to say one thing. We heard today, unfortunately, about the passing of Gary Griffin, who has been a stalwart XU fan, an alum, a guy who has been – if you were on a Xavier message board between about 1996 and about 2005, you probably know who Gary Griffin is. And he lost his –
The Musketeer Report.
Lost his battle with cancer, I guess, yesterday. And my thoughts, and I'm sure the thoughts of everybody on this podcast are with Gary and his family. So just wanted to say that before we adjourn tonight.
Absolutely. For the 42nd Tyrone Hill edition of the Dana and Victory podcast, he is Dan. The other guy you heard was the legend, Brian Snow. I am Rick Roaring. Thanks for listening, everybody.